When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to The Waves for Thursday, June 28th, the Jokes About Straight White Men edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, a host of NPR's Invisibilia. That is the very first time I've said welcome to The Waves. I'm so excited. I didn't know how it would sound coming out of my mouth, but it was fine. It was fine. I like it. I'm joined in the New York studios by June Thomas, senior managing producer of the Slate Podcast Network. Hi, June.
Hey, Hannah.
And Noreen is out today, so we have our very favorite special guest. Don't tell all the other special guests, Latifah Lyles. Hi, Latifah.
Hi, good morning.
Latifah is an expert on women and work, which she's talked to us about before, former director of the Women's Bureau at the Labor Department under Obama, and currently vice president of the National Network to End Domestic Violence. All of which is to say she knows a lot more than us about a lot of important things that we talk about all the time. Anyway, I'm glad you're with us.
Thanks, me too.
So, okay, I am back from vacation, so let's jump in. I'm excited to talk to you guys again. Before we get going, I want to let listeners know that we have a live show coming up on July 17th to celebrate the relaunch of The Waves. It's in D.C., and you should go to slate.com/live to get tickets. It is going to be an awesome show. We're going to have Ellen Stofan, the head of Air and Space. She was the chief scientist at NASA. So all you lady space nuts or men space nuts who are dreaming of going to Mars, you can come. And we will be auctioning off tickets for the first spaceship to Mars. Just kidding. We don't have that power, but you can ask her about it. And our also special musical guest, Back Eye, which Christina Cotterucci talked about on our last podcast, a great local band. All right, let's jump in. Today, we are going to talk about first Hannah Gadsby, Australian. Do you call Tasmanians Australians? Is that okay to do, June?
Absolutely.
But is there some like point of pride where you're supposed to say Tasmanian instead of Australian or not?
No, I don't think so. No, it's just a part of Australia. I mean, it's this very specific part, but I don't think there's a breakaway movement or anything.
Yeah. Okay. So an Australian comedian who breaks into the U.S. with a stunning monologue, which we will discuss. Second, we're going to talk about the Supreme Court ruling on crisis pregnancy centers. And finally, have we reached the end of the pantsuit era? Please God. We discuss changing fashion in politics. And June, you want to talk about our Slate Plus?
Yes, on Slate Plus this week, we will be asking, is it sexist that men, mostly men, but let's face it, men, get a free pass to watch the World Cup just openly, publicly, during work hours every 4 years.
Can't wait.
If you are not yet a Slate Plus member and you want to hear that conversation and all the other conversations that we have and all the other benefits of being a Slate Plus member, including a discount at live shows, including ours on July 17th, you should go to slate.com/thewavesplus.
Okay, let's get started with Hannah Gadsby. She's Australian. She's lesbian, which is important to her act. She now has a Netflix special out, which you can watch. But I think it's okay to listen to our conversation and then watch it. It's not a spoiler kind of thing. You'll read a lot about her as a new voice in comedy, which is only true in the U.S. She's been an Australian comedian for a while. How her show is perfect for the Me Too era, which is absolutely true. And yet I feel like none of those capture this weird, shaky, unnerving quality of this one-woman show, which isn't even really a comedy set, but it's more like a disturbing, neurotic monologue. So, June, will you just lay out the basics? Who is she? Where did she come from? Just tell us a little bit about her for people who haven't heard of her.
Yeah, you summarized a good lot of it there. She is a 40-year-old, I would say, butch, although she might just I don't know if she owns that word. She looks like a lesbian. She looks like me, is what
you
is
could
truth.
Say. Butch. I would.
Well, I don't
say
know.
Butch.
I don't know if that's how she identifies, but I'm just really glad because it's another famous, semi-famous person that I can be mistaken for. So that's great. It's funny. I just want to mention that last week we talked about rape jokes, Cameron Esposito's recent special, and I said when we were talking about topics, can we really talk about another lesbian stand-up set, you know, 2 weeks in a
only
row?
Only you could say that.
Well,
again.
I mean, but
only
also, like, I never in my life thought that that would be something that could ever be said. Like, can we really talk about yet another lesbian stand-up, you know, on this show that we do? Like, there's so many surprising things about that. Anyway, Hannah Gadsby is... As you said, Hannah, actually quite an established comedian in Australia, also very well known in Britain. This is her break into the States, and I think we can say it's a smash. She is a very specific kind of person, and like all good stand-ups, she really talks about herself and her own lived experience. I have to say that my girlfriend was so happy. She felt really seen because Hannah Gadsby talks about being kind of a quiet person and, you know, really enjoying the sound of a cup of tea, you know, hitting the saucer, that she's not really much of a party person. And so she doesn't think that she's terribly good at certain aspects of being gay, which has been very much associated with partying and, you know, gyrating in the streets. But she also is an art history graduate, which you would think, why are you mentioning that? Well, I think one of the things that was exciting about this special, Nanette, which the name is... has no bearing on what the topic of the set. She does a whole bit about art history, which is hard to describe, but is really swell, not only because it's very right on and very funny, but also because it feels really fresh. Like, I really haven't heard a lot of stand-up about Picasso and art history. This is also, like rape jokes, very much about bad things that happen, about sexual abuse, about being beaten up, and about having just really bad, hard things happen to you because of your place in the world and who you are and how you're perceived. And she talks about that in a really direct manner. She talks about how she's given up comedy because, well, I'll just say she talks a lot about how comedy works and how comedy, in some very sort of profound and existential ways, fails at what she's trying to do, which is really make some serious points and talk really fully about her life. And I realize I'm being a little bit vague, so I will send it back to you, Hannah.
Well, Latifa, did you, so June, like if I were a listener and I had not seen this and I heard what June just said, that she, you know, she talks about sexual abuse and art history, I'm not sure I would go rush and watch it. And there's not, you know, there's something to that. So I guess my question to you is, because I think this is critical to understanding her, did you think it was funny?
Well, I definitely thought she was funny. I could see her being kind of a funny person to hang out with. But I definitely didn't think of it in the traditional stand-up comedy routine. It felt more like a TED Talk with some funny bits. At one point, you know, during one of her enraged moments, I was like, it's kind of like a lament to her life and her like lost teenage self. I mean, it kind of reminded me more of spoken word, you know, in that respect.
And yeah,
where you listen, you want to be there, you're super supportive, but you cringe and hope nobody talks about body parts, which is my experience with spoken word poetry. So, you know, it definitely, she's funny, but, you know, it's not like, you know, when you unwind and kick back and, you know, you want to just laugh at the end of your day kind of thing at all. I do think that there were some very good questions that she poses to culture and society, including what it means to be funny and what it means for women and lesbians to be funny, and this sort of fundamental stereotype that, you know, lesbians are not funny and that's maybe why they're lesbians. And this idea that, mm-hmm. you know, if it's funny, like she at one point she said, you know, the only people this wouldn't be funny to are lesbians. So we have to laugh because otherwise it would be true, which I thought was just hilarious. And it does get to she did get to think things that I think are super important around, you know, how people take in like really heavy weighted, potentially triggering issues. And this idea that, you know, women can't take jokes / I'm being really gross and horrible to you and you should just laugh it off. And so she tried to turn that around. I'm not sure she was as successful because I don't think that she was necessarily being, you know, that aggressive to men, although she acknowledged that she was. This is am I attacking men, white men, right? White straight men right now, cisgender men? And she's like, absolutely. But I don't think it was really that. I think the point was, you know, she was trying to turn around. This is just locker room talk, yeah. You know, telling jokes about straight men. You know, just there's lots of things that you could pick up and think, you know, maybe if there was a whole bit about white straight white men, that would be interesting. I don't think she did that, but she was really trying to hit a lot in it about, you know, what we do with comedy and how we use that to shroud really serious and sensitive issues. So, you know, again, there's a lot of personal stuff that came up with that, which I was really surprised about, frankly. I was like, whoa, this is, you know, I need like a beer and my friends to be watching. You know, just the whole dynamic of her personal story and her like her purge, it kind of felt like was a little bit of a surprise. But it's different. And, you know, she clearly had a full audience. So I was glad for this expression of art. But it was definitely intense. But I think it was important an important piece to be out in the greater entertainment, you know, catalog of things you could be watching.
Did you find it funny, Hannah?
Oh, I absolutely loved it, and not because it was funny. I really thought it was one of the most brilliant monologues I've ever seen. It's really, like, for me, I think, in some ways, yeah. Because – or I just appreciated it because it's so much about the it's so meta, mm-hmm. and it's so dissecting itself while it's going through it. Mm-hmm. And I thought she did this whole bit about how comedy is about tension and release, yeah. and tension and release, and how there's a kind of formula to how you tell a joke, because much of comedy is unbelievably squirmishly uncomfortable. I mean, if you think of, like, even Louis C.K., like, mm-hmm. when she was talking about some of the things women do in comedy, I was like, well, men kind of, like, bear it. That's just an element of comedy that exists, and... But she kind of does the opposite, and it's really uncomfortable. She does, like, release and then tension. It's, mm-hmm. like, just when you're about to relax into a joke, she kind of, like, she gets incredibly spoken wordy on you. Mm-hmm. And unbelievably serious. And she's making this point about how comedy kind of freeze frames, like it lets you off the hook.
Yeah,
basically.
It stops before you get to the end of the story in her way of putting it.
And that whole analysis about the story, about how, like, you know, comedy just kind of like freezes the story in this particular place, which for the comedian freezes them in their trauma, and for everybody else kind of gives them a laugh, mm-hmm. and sort of, like, you know, releases the tension. And then she just kind of comes back to these ridiculously painful stories, which she's told as a joke, mm-hmm. 10 minutes earlier, and just kind of throws them in your face in the most uncomfortable way. She's like, oh, that wasn't the end of the story. Yeah. That was just the end of the joke. Here's the end of the actual story. And it's, like, so squirmingly uncomfortable that you can't believe this is a comedy set. You know, it's terrible. Yeah. The stuff she's talking about is not funny. And then she just kind of, like releases it and then brings the tension back. It's like everything she's doing in reverse. Even the name Nanette is a name that's about failure. So she's like, I'm naming it this for this idea I had, but the idea didn't really work. Do you know what I mean? It's like everything's moving backwards in her show.
Yeah. And it's a, you know, like all good comedy shows, it's an incredibly well constructed show. You know, the structure of the piece is quite complicated, but she moves you through it in a very gentle way so that you know, after the fact, you're like, oh, yeah, she kind of telegraphed that. But she does it in such a subtle way that you are, you know, you're kind of surprised in a good way, even though some of the surprises are, as you've both said, very heavy things. And she, you know, she has this thing that she keeps repeating that's mentioned in a lot of the reviews, where she says, you know, I've got to give up comedy. I've got to give up comedy for some of the reasons you mentioned, Hannah. And then at the end, she talks about anger. And when you really get to that, you know, because she gets angry and you realize that she, you know, she says, you know, because she's talked about how what laughter does to a room of strangers and how it unites them. And she talks about what anger can do for a room of strangers and how that can unite them and how dangerous that is and how it's never constructive. And that's like a really, really profound point. And that's what she ends on. She doesn't end, you know, about 5 minutes at least before the end of the set, she says, okay, that was the last joke.
One thing I found about her, there were definitely times when I wasn't convinced that she was a comedian. So obviously, this is the only thing I've ever seen of her as Nanette. So I was thinking to myself, this feels a little evangelical. It feels like, you know, someone's like bringing you in and it's very, very carefully plotted out for the intent of, you know, seeding these messages with you. And then she also talked about her, like, which is not uncommon for comedians and performers to be very introverted and not necessarily liking mm-hmm. to be on the stage or in the Pride Parade, for example.
Right.
So there was that juxtaposition, which is not unusual. There's lots of, you know, I know some comedians too who are terribly antisocial. but there were moments when I thought, is this just, you know, and then she talks about herself being the tension at one point. And so then mm-hmm. parts of it felt more like, you know, I'm doing this over explanation, which I felt a little bit about, but just a tiny bit. Mm-hmm. It was a bit over explanation. But she was also in this position where, which a lot of folks on the margins are, where it's like part of my job in life is to make you feel comfortable with me because I'm the tension. And I think that that was extremely and powerful and a point. And I looked at and sort of, you know, viewed the rest of the piece through that lens of, you know, how much is she being herself and how much is she really, you know, sort of taking these moments to just make sure you're comfortable and then doing what she really wants to do, which is to, you know, create these super uncomfortable moments where she's talking about, you know, the ills of society and the fact that, you know, we don't care about men and children or women and children in this world. And if we did, you know, women wouldn't be resorted to flesh and paintings and things like that. So, you know, there were definitely parts where I was sort of thinking about, you know, how much of this instructive way of doing the piece was about, you know, still feeling like I'm the uncomfortable conversation and I'm the uncomfortable thing. And so this is how I navigate through the world. And this is how I'm navigating this really hard conversation I'm trying to have with you is through this comedy formula.
Yeah. And even that victim thing she did at the end, that's a good point, Latifah, about her being the tension in the room, because at the end she was like, I don't want to be a victim. And you weren't sure what to do with that mm-hmm. because essentially that is her monologue, talks about being marginalized and being a victim. But then you think back to her childhood and it's almost like revenge, you know, like in her childhood, she was just kind of like, it seemed you like I just had an image of her just kind of navigating, making a joke to make everyone around everyone around her who was maybe like evangelical and uncomfortable with who she was feel more comfortable. Mm-hmm. And now it's like she's reversed that, like I'm going to make everybody uncomfortable, which isn't exactly being the victim as we understood the victim, because her politics, like if you thread it, I don't know, it's a comedy set or a monologue, so it doesn't totally hold together as like you couldn't write out the coherent politics of Hannah Gadsby, you know?
I mean, mm-hmm. that's interesting to me though, Hannah, because I mean, she uses that word victim and she talks about what has happened to her, but I think she's, you know, that's not an identity, like she's trying to move from that. Like she's sharing it because she wants people to know her. And as she says, you know, she wants to offer people role models. Again, these are all things that don't sound like they belong in a comedy show. But I don't think that, you know, this is about victimhood. This is about, you know, I think there's one line where she says, there is nothing stronger than a broken woman who has rebuilt herself. Now, not funny, but that's kind of, again, a pretty profound statement about what you do when you recognize that something really terrible has happened to you. But how do you move on? You rebuild. But you have to kind of acknowledge the truth before you can rebuild. So for me, it's not about sort of marinating in victimhood. It's about like moving the narrative. You don't stop the narrative at that point. You move on to what happened next. Like it all feels like that's part of the you know, the same story. It's another example of doing that. You do that in a comedy set and you also do it in life. And I have to say too that I thought this show, you know, I recognize so much that what we're saying doesn't sound like it's terribly funny, but I thought it was very funny. I really laughed a lot and felt very seen by it. And I think it's an amazing piece too. Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny, but she's not like, you don't get, she's not trying to please you. You know what I mean?
Right,
you do not get the sense that she's trying to give you a good time.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So like Latifa said, that kind of keeps you uncomfortable as you're sitting and watching when the person who's entertaining you is not really trying to entertain you. There's like a fuck you under so much of what she's doing, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, listeners, we urge you to go watch Hannah Gadsby's Netflix special. It's called Nanette. And you should write us and tell us what you think at thewaves@slate.com.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Okay, so now let's move on to our Supreme Court topic. So the Supreme Court spit out its end-of-term rulings this week, and one of them involved crisis pregnancy centers. The court ruled that a California law requiring these centers to supply women with information about abortion likely violates the First Amendment. With us to discuss today is Slate's legal correspondent, Mark Joseph Stern. Hi, Mark.
Hi. How are you doing?
Good. Excellent. You must be exhausted. The ruling's coming at you. You've got to like be smart and digest them all. It's like a stressful time of year.
It's horrible. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, okay, before we get into it, I'm just going to give a very basic, like, what is it? As a person who has written a lot about American religion and evangelicals, just the very basics. You know, sometimes you go around town and you see those pregnant need help signs around the country. They likely are pointing you to a crisis pregnancy center. These were started by evangelicals, I don't know, maybe 30, 40 years ago. They started sprouting up everywhere. They advertise as giving women pregnancy information, but they're designed not exclusively. They're designed for lots of things to kind of help you through your pregnancy, but they are also designed to discourage women or give you another, steer you away from getting an abortion. So California passed this law saying they have to give you information about abortions. So, Mark, what specifically was the California law trying to get these centers to do?
So the California law, which is called the FACT Act, does two different things. First, it requires crisis pregnancy centers to provide information somewhere displayed in their offices as to where women can get free or low-cost reproductive health care, including the full range of reproductive health care, which obviously encompasses abortion and birth control. So under this provision of the law, if you are a CPC, you would have to disclose somewhere a little sign that says, for information about free or low-cost health care for women, call this number. The second part of the law was even simpler. It would have required unlicensed crisis pregnancy centers, so CPCs that do not actually have a license to practice medicine, to disclose their lack of a license, both at the center and in advertisements for the center. So if this law had been upheld, for instance, when a CPC put up a sign that said pregnant need help, call this number, and if it was unlicensed, it would have had to include some kind of disclosure there that said, oh, by the way, we don't actually have a license to practice medicine.
The court made a slightly different ruling about each of these segments of the law, right?
Yeah, that's right. But the gist of it was largely the same. So with regard to the first part of the law, requiring these crisis pregnancy centers to disclose the phone number and information about free or low-cost reproductive health care, including abortions, the court, in an opinion by Justice Clarence Thomas, joined only by the conservative justices, said that this was a content-based restriction on speech, and that it was simply attempting to compel these crisis pregnancy centers to speak information that they did not want to express. And the court rejected this notion that the state has a stronger interest in regulating, quote, professional speech than it does most kinds of speech, because the court said, well, you know, the government can engage in censorship in a lot of different ways, and it's especially invidious to try to intervene in the doctor-patient process, the relationship, to try to compel certain kinds of doctors and medical establishments to express an ideology that the state holds. And so that was a pretty clear and I think inevitable First Amendment decision. The second part of the decision was a little bit stranger because the court held long ago that it's perfectly fine under most circumstances for the government to compel the disclosure of factual information. So for instance, all of the food you eat has to have the number of calories in it per serving. You know, cigarettes have a warning label on them. There are all kinds of regulations about what products and services have to disclose, and this law merely required CPCs to disclose factual information. So it seemed that this part of the law stood a pretty good chance of being upheld, but the same coalition of five justices struck down that as well because they held that under precedent, a law requiring factual disclosures cannot be unduly burdensome. And the court found that the way this particular law was written, the way it would be implemented, it would be extremely burdensome for CPCs for a number of reasons, but largely because they would have to include it in their advertising. And the court noted that they'd have to include it in a number of different languages under this law. And in Los Angeles County, for instance, they might have to disclose their lack of a medical license in as many as 13 different languages. And so the court said, look, that is way too burdensome. It is clearly another invidious restriction on freedom of expression. So we're going to strike that down as well. And the whole law before us is, in fact, unconstitutional.
But now, how does this affect other people in other states? Because it sure feels from my untutored eye that this was essentially prime, allowing religious belief because the view was that these clinics are often established, as Hannah said, by people with religious beliefs, it's prioritizing their religious beliefs over the health needs maybe of women who just need advice and help and maybe medical assistance. As I read many of these clinics, and there are more than 2,700 of them around the country, even the unlicensed ones have their staff wearing scrubs. They make or ask patients to fill in a medical history questionnaire. They're trying to sort of present themselves as medical clinics. And yet, so it seems to me that what the law was trying to establish was truth in advertising. You know, don't be deceptive. That it's not saying these clinics can't exist. It's just saying if you're not really providing medical support, if you're not really providing medical help, you need to not pretend to be a medical establishment.
Right. So that was certainly California's argument before the court. But in a separate concurring opinion that Justice Anthony Kennedy wrote, you see where a majority of justices, I think, landed on this. Justice Kennedy was joined by Chief Justice John Roberts, as well as Justices Samuel Alito and Neil Gorsuch. And he claimed that California was engaging in an authoritarian practice of essentially targeting faithful Christians and trying to force them to carry the state's pro-abortion ideology. So to the conservative justices, your explanation is just pretext for what California was actually doing, which is cracking down on evangelical Christians and preventing them from exercising their beliefs as they see fit. Now, whether Kennedy and Thomas are correct is certainly a matter of debate. All four liberal justices dissented in an opinion written by Justice Stephen Breyer. And he said, look, your ruling here imperils a vast range of factual disclosure requirements, because the truth is that all kinds of government regulation target speech, from, you know, health and safety codes to securities and exchange rules. At some point in the process of regulation, there's always some kind of expression. And the court's decision here kind of seems to open the door for future judges to just strike down any regulation that they don't like under the pretext of, oh, well, it violates free speech and forces citizens to carry the state's ideology.
You know what? I actually found that part really interesting because, here's what I wondered about. Was there something in the law that kind of showed their hand, kind of signaled that intent to kind of shut down pregnancy crisis centers? And then if it's true that there was some kind of political motivation behind the law, wouldn't it apply to the other side as well? So the pregnancy crisis centers could kind of plausibly say, look, the thing that you're asking us to do violates the very sort of essence of what we're about. And then isn't it thus also true that all the laws that require abortion providers to, you know, give bullshit information about abortion that's not medically proven, like it makes you depressed or, you know, whatever it is, the list of things you have to say about abortion violates the very thing that they're about? Like, isn't it similarly true on the other side?
Well, that was certainly the hope. And when the court first took this case, Dahlia Lithwick and I wrote a piece to that effect saying, look, if California can't require CPCs to disclose the state's information here, then surely also abortion providers can't be compelled to disclose whatever an anti-abortion state wants it to tell patients. You know, abortion causes breast cancer, most women regret their abortion, the fetus is a person, you know, all kinds of ideological stuff that currently many red states force abortion providers to tell their patients. But unfortunately, Justice Thomas ended up writing this opinion in a way that kind of excludes those laws from the sweep of the ruling. So Thomas says, and I don't find this convincing at all, but Thomas says, well, when the state actually requires a doctor to speak certain words to a patient shortly before or over the course of a medical procedure, that looks to us more like the standard practice of medicine. And we're okay with that because it's just attempting to protect the patient's health and safety and welfare. It's different, Thomas says, when the state requires a doctor's office to put up a sign in the waiting room or to include disclosures in all of its advertisements carrying the state's message, you know, about the hot topic of abortion.
You know, the other thing about this conversation is that it really takes us very, very far away. And, you know, the arguments and the legal arguments made in defense by California is that, honestly, the thing that is really present here is that a lot of these crisis pregnancy centers are in places where there are very limited obstetric or any kind of reproductive care, whether it's an abortion clinic or just, you know, a hospital with obstetric service. So the idea that there's this sort of, you know, the harm created by this parading out as a potentially, you know, medical facility in certain places, probably not in most places in California, but in lots of other places around the country, there's a real concrete, are you parading as a hospital or a clinic when we know there are, you know, 34% of, or something like 30% of rural counties don't even have hospitals with obstetric services, and millions of women don't have any obstetric care access at all. And certainly lots of clinics have been closing more than ever in the past few years in several states, are just down to even one abortion provider. So this idea, you know, so in the face of the fact that there could theoretically be people really seeking a medical obstetric facility, walking into one of these crisis pregnancy centers is a very major reality for a lot of people. Like I said, probably not in, you know, in most places in California, but certainly in a lot of other rural places and remote places in the country.
Yeah, so I think that's absolutely right. I think that that's also only a concern if you think that a woman's right to terminate her pregnancy or to carry her pregnancy to term are on equal moral and legal footing, which a majority of the Supreme Court does not. Even though Justice Kennedy will occasionally vote to strike down really draconian restrictions on abortion access, he is personally anti-abortion. He has made that quite clear. And the other four conservative justices just hate abortion. And so to them, I think what you just described is a feature, not a bug, of this ruling and of this issue. They think that it's perfectly fine that many women will not be able to access a clinic that provides the full spectrum of reproductive care. They think, hey, maybe it's better that a woman wanders into a CPC and is given an ultrasound and 2 hours of anti-abortion lectures. That to them is just the marketplace of ideas at work. And so, you know, Justice Breyer talks about this in his dissent, and it's really kind of hints at, again, the motivated reasoning behind, I think, the majority's decision here. The court does not honestly grapple with the fact that it is letting CPCs get away with fraud, that this is at least borderline fraudulent behavior in many instances, and California is trying to prevent fraud. And now the court says, well, you don't get to do it this way. I do think that there's an opening here for California to go back to the drawing board and try to craft a narrower law that does target expressly fraudulent practices more specifically. You know, the court was very disturbed by the breadth of this law. And I can understand why. I actually think that there was a chance that Justice Kagan and maybe even Justice Breyer would have joined a much narrower ruling, kind of nipping away at the edges of the breadth of the law, but upholding the core of it. But, you know, the majority had 5 votes, so they did what they do and struck down the whole thing. That gives California, I do think, an opportunity to go back and try to figure out how to target these clinics where they know real, actual consumer fraud is going on and try to crack down on those rather than regulate the entire field of CPCs in the state.
Yeah, that seems like the good future to hope for, because I get it. I can see where the debate is around, do you have to inform people about abortion as an option or put a sign up? But the other thing seems clear to me, like you can't masquerade as a health clinic. I mean, just like as a business issue, as a consumer protection issue, I don't know about as a legal issue, but could you write some law that addressed that element of it? You know, you can't masquerade as a doctor and a nurse when you're not a doctor and a nurse, and sort of leave aside the you have to inform people about the option of abortion and at least take care of that one part of it.
Yeah, I think there is a way for California to do that. I think it will need to get a very smart legislative drafter, because Thomas's majority opinion does say, well, if the state gets to decide what counts as a licensed medical provider, then the state can manipulate those standards to disfavor providers whose ideology it opposes. And so the California legislature is going to have to figure out how to diffuse all of the ideological tension in this case and create extremely neutral standards for what counts as a licensed medical provider and what does not. It's going to be complicated, but I do think it's possible. And I agree that that is the provision of this law that seemed extremely reasonable, that I'm a bit surprised the court reached out and struck the whole thing down. Because, again, you know, you're right that requiring providers to put up a big sign saying, here's where you can get your abortion, that does raise, I think, legitimate First Amendment questions. But simply requiring factual disclosures that you don't have a real doctor on staff, that just seems like common sense.
Yeah. Okay. Our listeners in California who are lawyers and very neutral minded, go craft a neutral statute and get it out there that will get the job done.
Yep. Sounds good to me.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks.
All right. Our next topic, which is pantsuits. With so many women running for office, we reopen the question of what they have to look like. For the most part, prominent American women politicians have stayed in a narrow range. The wives, they can stray and become fashion icons like Michelle Obama, or wear weird fashion choices like Melania did at the border this week. But the politicians, the actual female politicians, usually stick to a suit, maybe a colorful suit, even though it's no longer 1986. So this week, a writer, Vanessa Friedman, wrote a New York Times article where she went to women's campaign school and went to a class called Dress to Win and asked, what does that mean in 2018 to dress to win? So I'm making Latifa go first because she just won. I voted for Latifa. She won a local office. You must have done some campaigning, and you're enough in the political world that I'm sure you think about how to present yourself and what is socially acceptable.
Yes, indeed I do.
So what did you wear?
So mostly in this very local but fun race, I wore campaign t-shirts. So, you know, we're very dressed down, very casual.
Why?
In this particular case, because we ran as a slate, so it was really important for people to vote for the ticket, which wasn't something you're forced to do at the ballot box. So a big part of the strategy is to recognize our campaign name, and that was the most important thing as opposed to individual imagery in this particular case. But you know, having done other political work before, well, I will say something about the t-shirt, though. I do think, and, you know, there was the New York reports out from the New York race this week and lots of photos of folks also in communities and sort of dressed down. I think there's a difference between campaign wear, and sort of when you're in office, and the difference between what you're wearing on the Hill or in chambers versus if you're going to a community. And having worked with lots of, you know, high level officials, you know, just as much as you need to know the stats of where you're going and the hot issues of the day and the economic situation in this town, you know, part of all the briefing materials for any high level person in Washington also includes dress code, because when you're going out to communities, you really, you know, I think in this day and age, you've got to relate to people. There's a lot of, I think, doubt and mistrust of the typical politician these days. So I think there's been a lot more campaign pieces and mailers with folks in their shirt sleeves, or if that's how you call it, or, you know, rolled up cuffs. And
what is a female rolled up cuff? Like, I get what the dudes either wear, like a polo shirt, if they're trying to look like of the people. The guys, they don't like really wear like a grimy, like I'm barbecuing shirt that the people would wear. They wear like a rolled up. Yeah, it's
no
like
jacket,
a crisp shirt,
no tie.
But like, mm-hmm. No jacket, no tie. What is the female of the people look?
So, I think that there has been a huge new wave of just wearing dresses. I don't think that the colored shirt and khakis works as well for women. But I think that there's a lot more you can wear a dress with, you know, flats, God forbid, or, you know, a cardigan with this is so specific, but like a twin set as long as you accessorize appropriately. So if you have a twin set, it's fine, but you usually need to have like pearls or some kind of like a elaborate choker.
You're going too fast for me, because I'm like, what kind, like, it can't be too expensive, right? But it can't be too frumpy. Like, you got to
So I think
exactly
of like a teacher.
Right. A teacher.
Yeah. So it's like, you know, you have the little shell underneath, and then you have like a little cardigan over it and some slacks that could be, you know, an ankle. You don't have to go all the way down. That's another casual thing these days where you don't have on long slacks, but you have on like pencil slacks. And I think the heel versus flat is also very significant in terms of, you know, being of the people, not too much bling. I've been on the campaign trail back in the day with some very prominent politicians. And I'm like, you really didn't wear that ring to this community event, did you? So I think that's the other piece of it, too, is because, you know, we're in D.C., you're wearing your glitz and your bling. And I think that's another thing for women is like not too much. We're not blinding people with your engagement rings and, you know, nothing too fancy. But I think that's simple accessorizing, flats, cardigans, dresses. I think that's where we are in the campaign realm.
One of the things that we haven't mentioned, and it's really great to hear like positive aspects of political dress code, and that you actually feel like you are dressing as you like to rather than you have to. But we should mention that many a time, women who are candidates are just so aware that they're having to make choices not because of fitting in with the crowd that they're sort of pitching themselves to or with what they're comfortable, but to what will expose them to the least judgment. I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, who's to tell? I don't know Hillary Clinton. Maybe she really loves wearing pantsuits. I've not seen her since the election, so I don't know if she's still wearing them now. But I don't think she was wearing them because she liked it or because it made her fit in. I think it was to avoid judgment. I think a lot of the time, you know, just to state the obvious, women candidates are judged on their appearance, judged on, you know, for example, wearing a dress. Well, some people would, but don't want to be like have their legs, you know, rated on a scale of 1 to 10 or whatever. I mean, yeah. Women are exposed to a lot more judgment. I just have to throw out the example of Shirley Williams, a politician from Britain, who could, I think, have been prime minister. She was a Labour politician, especially important in the 70s and 80s. And she was famously had very messy hair. People would always say, does she even comb her hair? And her hair was like the thing that everybody talked about. She was really a very brilliant politician. She was perhaps, you know, the great political mind of her time. But I truly believe that all this talk about her appearance and her hair was what caused her to not become the absolute top leadership. And in the end, she left the Labour Party. She formed what was then the Lib Dem. It was a breakaway party from the Labour Party. Maybe Labour would have been in power more in the 80s. I mean, there's just so many consequences that fell after Shirley Williams just being judged on her messy hair. And I think that happens hopefully a lot less now. It's been interesting for me to see Stacey Abrams, the first black woman to, ever to be a candidate for, major party candidate for governor who's in the race in Georgia. I had to, of course, I don't want to be the white woman who gets black women's hair wrong. So I looked in Essence to see what they call their hair. And she has a natural twist out hairstyle.
Yes, she does.
I said that very naturally, I'm sure. She's got a lot of credit for, not a lot of credit, but a lot of attention for wearing dresses. She always looks great. She looks very comfortable, and that feels important. And she looks like she's being herself. I mean,
she looks good. I mean, you know, in the twist.
She looks good. She looks great. Yeah.
If you look at, I mean, this is terrible, but we're talking about how people dress. Yeah. But looking at photos of her in suits versus photos of her in dress, she just looks so much more comfortable. And she looks just so much more well put together in the dresses than she does in the suits, frankly. So, and she's doing really well.
Yeah.
The hair choice is another thing for African-American candidates and African-American women. And you see lots of variations on the Hill now, but that's another major part of it since you mentioned hair. In terms of like major icons, there was also conversations about people talk about portrayals in the media. Certainly from various shows, there's a reference to the old show Commander in Chief, which was very short-lived, and I didn't watch it, but everyone loves Gina Davis.
I watched it.
Yeah. Did you? Madam Secretary, House of Cards.
Yeah.
But I will say that I have a like political fashion icon. Granted, this is a very high-level position, but Julia Louis-Dreyfus and Veep, I think, is so brilliantly dressed.
Yes. Wait, so define her dress. You mean it's like she wears dresses. She looks good. She wears dresses that fit well. And it's like a little bit conservative, but a little bit like, you know, of the moment. They're like stylish dresses, but not crazy stuff.
Yeah, they're fashionable. She looks like she's in fashion.
And she's also like incredibly trim. Like, you know, even if I was a dress wearing person, I couldn't wear what she wears because, like, I would look like I was, you know, squashed into a sausage skin or something. Like, it's very, very important that it's also, I mean, of course, she's an actress, but I mean, like, it's very flattering because she, like, as everybody says, and cannot not say about her. She looks amazing. She's in amazing shape and she's, you know, she's flawless.
But it is amazing to me as an outsider, Latifah, like listening to you talk and how you've navigated this like across a career in politics and, you know, in public organizations. It's like we have fought in 2018 for the right to wear a slightly stylish sheath dress. Like, that's amazing. Like, what if June were running for
exactly.
office? Like, could
no, we've
June
moved
dress
from the sheath.
And
we've
be
moved
June?
From the sheath. That's a definite. I would say this. We can do the A-line with a we can do a flounce with a belt.
Flounce so, with a belt.
Okay. That would be my look. I think we've moved beyond sheath. I need to make that distinction, especially in the summer. And if you, sometimes you can do flounce with a jacket, which is, you know, you have that option. But, you know, obviously the sheath stands alone.
Sheath stands alone, absolutely.
But one day we'll be able to, like, you'll be able to dress like June and run for office. No, not to put you in the spot,
oh,
June,
no,
but, like,
no.
I'm just thinking, like, okay, we've expanded the expression and Latifah's, like, a positive person.
Exactly,
really
exactly. Before we leave this topic, we cannot not mention the politician or politician-adjacent dress question of the last week, which was Melania's jacket that said on the back of it, and it was from Thara and cost about $40, and it said on the back, "I really don't care. Do you?" What do we think about that? It can only be said
great.
In that tone. I don't really. I really don't care. Do you? What do we think about the jacket? In six words or less.
You know, I can't just say that I had respect for it, but it was such a Jesus. Like, what
it was a fuck you, wasn't
choice.
It?
It was such a fuck you, like post-irony. I hear you all and I'm not listening. I mean, it was kind of amazing. Jesus. I'm not saying I admire it, but no. Jesus, was that like a not a sheath dress moment?
Right. No, definitely. And I think there's something about the fact that we spent a lot of time thinking about what's really going on. Where is she? Is she okay? Is she one of like that? It definitely put a lot of that to rest, too, where there's this musings about the real Melania, and there she goes.
I think it was like she's sick of, like, we think of her as a blank space, like with no real life and no internal life. And that was a definite kind of, you know, message that I'm not a blank space. You know, I don't know whose idea it was.
I think we can agree it means something. Something.
It means something. Indeed. Yeah, absolutely. All right, listeners, I'll give you two this time. If you have views on Melania's jacket that haven't been expressed, or you have experience running for office or a story to tell us about a time you ran for something public and had to adjust what you wore or were criticized, please share it with us at thewaves@slate.com. We would love to hear from you. Let's move on to our recommendations. To join us today, we have the one, the only, the very special, our production assistant, started as our intern, Daniel Schrader. Today is his last week with us, which is so sad for us because we have raised him up as a pup, and now he is a man, as you will see when he starts to speak. So we're going to let Daniel go first and share with us, because he is just like a font of awesome cultural consumption. So today we get to actually hear about it on his last week.
Oh,
hi,
gosh.
And bye, Daniel.
Yeah, hi.
That's
thanks,
a high
Hannah. I'm excited to be on mic. I'm sorry it's my last time here, but I've had a great time. Loved working with you all these past 2 years. I can't believe it's been 2 years.
Me neither.
Amazing.
But yeah, it's been great. So I guess for my recommendations, because I only get to do this once, I figured I'd recommend seven things. I have two, though. So they're both gay things because it's Pride Month, and that's just how it has to be. Sorry. So one of them is this this YouTube series called The Gay and Wondrous Life of Caleb Gallo, which came out a couple years ago. It's created by Brian Jordan Alvarez, who's a gay comedy person, actor in L.A. And it's just such a funny, smart, fresh interpretation of gay life in your 20s and the friends that you create and the friendships that you build around you. And it's just such a fun thing. My roommate and I watched it this weekend because it was Pride weekend, and we just couldn't have been happier and filled with more joy and gay feelings. And then the other one is a video that's, I believe, on Vimeo called The Disgustings, and it was created by Jordan Firstman, and stars Jordan Firstman and Drew Drogi, who are both two LA comedian people, and they are just some of my favorite people of all time. It's the video I show anyone whenever they're like over at my apartment. They're like, what should we do? I'm like, oh, we have to watch The Disgustings. It's about these two LA vapid gay guys who also seem to have like such tragic inner lives, but are trapped in that tragedy and yet so vacuous that they don't realize it. And it's just wonderful. So those are my recommendations.
Oh, wow. My God, that sounds so fun. I'm going to totally steal that for my party friends who come over. That sounds amazing. Well, Daniel, it's been amazing having you. You've been the best researcher, supporter, everything you've done. We've really, really loved having you. So thank you.
Thank you.
And Daniel's not leaving Slate, by the way. He's just going on to bigger and better.
Yeah, I'm working on The Gist now.
Yeah, he's beyond females. Just kidding. Just kidding. All right, well, June, you want to go next?
Sure. I want to recommend an FX show that has completed its run, but without me noticing it. And then so I just went back in the last weekend and inhaled the entire thing and felt really kind of embarrassed that I had let it go under my radar. And that is the series Trust, which was made by Simon Beaufoy, who most recently made The Battle of the Sexes. And he's worked with Danny Boyle, who's also involved with this show. It is I think 10-part series about the 1973 kidnapping of John Paul Getty III. And it has some amazing actors in it. Like Hilary Swank, Jack Bauer's dad. Donald Sutherland. A lot of fantastic actors. And it's set in the world of the Gettys and this really mean, horrific billionaire who was just sort of horrible to his children. In a weird way, kind of for the first time ever, I understood in a way that I'd not before why rich people so often get involved with drugs. Like, if that's what your parents are like, I totally understand. But anyway, that's a side note. Because he was kidnapped in Italy, that is to say, John Paul Getty III was kidnapped in Italy, we actually see a lot about the Calabrian mafia. And it's just really beautifully filmed. It's really an extraordinary show that I absolutely loved, and it is Trust on FX.
I've seen so many previews for that. I am excited to know that it's good. It's sexy, you know, so I was curious about it. And I'm really interested in the family, so good to know that it's good. Okay, I have a much quieter recommendation, quiet, since we've been praising quiet. I have been on vacation, so I read a lot when I'm on vacation. And the book that I read that I loved is called Go, Went, Gone. It's by Jenny Erpenbeck. It is translated from the German. It's about this retiree and his relationship with a group of refugees who show up in Germany. It is really, truly a beautiful novel. There's a sentence in it which it has stuck in my head, and I think in all the wrong ways. Do you guys think I should read the sentence? And
sure.
Then listeners of a certain age, if this resonates with you, it's been really depressing me, even though I think the novel's amazing. And actually, the point of the novel runs against this, but I'm just going to read this. Learning to stop wanting things is probably one of the most difficult lessons of getting older. But if you don't learn to do that, your desires will be like a belly full of stones dragging you down into your grave. Now, that's a terrible advertisement for this book because it's actually not that depressing. The whole book is about him learning to find a certain desire. But anyway, that sentence has been rolling around in my head in a very bad way.
Woo.
Like, is that really what you have to do? All right. So since I've depressed you all, Latifa, do you have anything positive and happy for us?
Maybe. Depends. So this is a book, a newish book from my old friend and novelist Curtis Sittenfeld. Mm. You Think It, I'll Say It, which was released, I believe, earlier this spring. And it's been described in many ways. The great thing about it is I love short stories. I love collections, especially because I read multiple things at once. And this is a short story collection. I think it's her first short story collection. They're all centered around women. Some people have described it as, you know, be middle America, middle-aged moms. Some of the titles of the shorts are called – one is the nominee about someone for office. One is called The Regular Couple. One is called Gender Studies. There's been a lot of reference to mean girls and bitchy characters who are not necessarily nice. But told in a very, very compelling and engaging, engrossing way. And she's just a great writer. And Somebody that I know well, and she's always engrossing, which, you know, for me right now is what I need. I need to be engrossed away from the gross.
That is bouncing back to me. My daughter and my husband just read that. We're huge Curtis Sittenfeld fans too, so that comes back to me very soon. So I'm glad to know you liked it. All right, everyone. Well, that is our show today. Thanks, as always, to our fabulous producer and sometimes host, Farrellyn Williams, and for the last time, to our beautiful production assistant, Daniel Schrader. Thank you, Daniel. I got to get these right now because we have a new name and this is my first time. So please email us at thewavesofslate.com. You can tweet at any of us, at June Thomas, at Hannah Rosen, or at Latifa Lyles if you have anything to say to us. For Latifa and June, I'm Hannah Rosen, and we'll be here next week.